This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Gazelle Full Circle Resale. Now accepting like-new natural fiber clothing, jewelry, accessories, and curios. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-284-4192.
And a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws. Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, a weekly program about working people, the labor movement, and organizing on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Don McIntosh. On tonight's show, the all-powerful Teachers Union. I'm joined in the studio by Oregon Education Association lobbyist Laurie Wimmer Whalen to talk about underfunding, overtesting, privatizing, pay-for-performance schemes, and the influence of conservative private foundations on public education. Laurie, welcome to Labor Radio.
Thank you so much, Don.
You are kind of a major figure, I think, at this point in the state's biggest union, Oregon Education Association. You've been a lobbyist now in Salem for them for how long?
I've been there for a decade, and before that, lobbied for women's rights. So I've been in Salem for about 16 years.
And let's maybe find out just a little bit about the Oregon Education Association. Not everyone is necessarily familiar with it, but for those who are, it's basically the big teachers union in the state of Oregon, right?
Right. We represent 46,000 people who work in Oregon's K through 12 and community college classrooms, whether they be certified teachers, community college faculty, or education support professionals at both venues.
I hear you guys have a lot of clout that you're running the state. Is there any truth to that?
No, I would suggest that there are 90 legislators and a governor who are running the state of Oregon.
But, you know, I raise that sort of tongue-in-cheek, but I mean that is, I just find again and again over the years, a constant theme in a kind of ultra-conservative dialogue, that somehow that the teachers union in particular has, you know, a nefarious lock on state government. What do you think contributes to that view, or how do you react to something like that? I don't know if you go on Lars Larson very often.
I try not to. prefer a friendlier venue. I believe that because my members have represented both in Oregon and nationally the rights of working people, they've articulated the needs and interests of the students they serve, and they stand as the last effective guardian against such failed experiments as school vouchers and the anti-tax movement, anti-government movement in general, that we are seen as barriers that impede the success of those folks from achieving their political ends. And so if there's any venom out there, it's really not for what we stand for, but for the obstacle we present in protecting democracy and education.
And I would say, in particular, you've been an obstacle over the years to Bill Sizemore, a failed carpet salesman, I think, and a former governor candidate for the Republican Party in Oregon. You know, he's well known as this anti-tax crusader, and of course, each one of his measures, in effect, requires you guys to really get out the troops and contribute, because ultimately, tax dollars fund schools. You see your members' interests as being needing to defend them.
That's correct. And, you know, we believe in the marketplace of ideas. We don't characterize people. We don't demonize them for their ideas. But we will, of course, articulate our members' vision of how we think things ought to go. And my members have put a fair amount of resources behind that.
One of the things you did, I think, direct attack actually on Bill Sizemore is you found that his use of basically fraud, signature fraud, electoral fraud, corporations fraud, really marred the elections process in the year 2000, and you guys were the lead plaintiff in a suit that that ultimately was supposed to put him out of business. Now, I would be curious to know about why he still seems to be in business, but you guys won a jury award of several million dollars against Bill Sizemore, basically because he had gone after you guys specifically, getting some ballot initiatives out there that he knew you'd have to spend money to fight.
Right, and he still to this day credits himself as keeping us distracted. That was sort of the purpose, back to my original point about the right, that they see us more for the, you know, the enemy only in the sense that we represent interests different from their agenda, and so they want to go after us or keep us busy, as he has always claimed to. With respect to that particular individual, again, it's the ideas that we found unpalatable, not the person. The fact that he committed an abuse of our electoral system was just another piece of that story, and of course, when you get someone on videotape committing a crime, that's helpful to the Secretary of State because they don't have the resources for a large enforcement team. So they rely on people's goodwill to be good citizens. And Oregonians love their initiative process, but I think they fail to realize how rife it is for abuse.
Not this program is going to focus on Sizemore, but before we leave that, I just wanted to share, you know, a number of years ago, I'm a reporter for a labor union newspaper, as you know, the Northwest Labor Press, nwlaborpress.org, check it out. I'm a reporter, and, you know, a number of years ago, I was out in Forest Grove, attending a debate at Pacific University, amongst the political science students there, or I should say for them, between Bill Sizemore, on the one hand, and Jim Sager, who was at the time, I believe he was the head of the Portland Association of Teachers, the teachers, union local of your organization, but it's based in Portland. And the debate topic was, I believe, teachers unions, good or bad. And of course, Bill Sizemore argued that teachers unions are bad, in particular that they, drive up the wages or something to that effect. What is the your response to that concern that maybe that if teacher pay is, and benefits are too generous, that ultimately comes in conflict with students' needs, maybe like they would have more money to hire more teachers if teachers decided to make less money, and then have more teachers in the schools and smaller class sizes?
You know, it's a wonderful question. It usually is propounded by those same people who like to run government like a business. And, of course, in the business world, the maxim is you get what you pay for. And you have a profession in which we are building the human capital of the state, which has economic consequences as well as, you know, the human investment consequence. And we are one of eight states in the nation that require a master's degree, for example, for continuing licensure. It would seem to me common sense that you would, in an industry so labor-intensive, be very focused on attracting the best and the brightest and retaining them. We have a problem with new teachers leaving the profession in the first 5 years. Upwards 40% to 50% choose to leave teaching after an enormous investment has been made in building that professional's young career. It's an economic issue, and it's also a tragedy because we have a lot of very bright and talented people who know that with their education they can do a lot of other things that they feel has a better public perception in terms of support, and that will grant them more money. It's the least well-paid professional profession for the level of education you have to get, even in Oregon, where we do better than some states.
If in case you just joined us, you're listening to Labor Radio. We're talking with Laurie Wimmer Whalen, who is the, what's your official the title, government relations consultant or something like
Correct.
That? Okay, for the Oregon Education Association, which is the teachers union in Oregon. You know, not all states have actually even the right for teachers or public employees to unionize. Do you know, is that a rare thing in Oregon, or is it has it become pretty common?
Well, there's a collective bargaining law in Oregon passed with the help of our current governor, as a matter of fact, Kulongoski, in 1973, called the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, PECBA for short. And I think about 30 states are organized with similar kinds of collective bargaining laws. And it's brought relative labor peace over the years. It's been a good way for both management and workers to resolve their issues and to determine the best interests and needs of their school districts as a result over the years. It's been something that we've been very happy as a part of Oregon law and happy to protect.
You know, the reason I ask that in part is because I feel like what we're seeing in the last few years, maybe the last 5-10 years, is a kind of ideological targeting of teachers' unions. You go back to, for example, the Bush's first term Secretary of Education, Rodney Page, called your national affiliate, the National Education Association, the biggest terrorist organization in America, which seemed a little bit extreme, given that you know they were the folks that you know were teaching your kids in kindergarten and high school and so forth. And their plan was their signature achievement really in that first term for education, the Bush administration. No Child Left Behind, because there's a lot of jokes, I think, in progressive circles about that. But, I mean, what does that mean on the ground for your members? What's it doing to education?
Well, we call it No Child Left Untested because it's really a means of putting high-stakes testing as the only relevant motivational achievement goal to measure. And that puts kids at risk, particularly who are struggling students, for example. If you set an arbitrary line that this is the standard to which all students must rise, and you don't provide the resources to help students achieve and to overcome their incapacities where you may find them, whether they are, not good at math and needing more tutorials in that, or whether they have language barrier problems or special needs students, special education students still have to sit for those tests under the federal law. We've become this test-crazed nation that believe that it's more important to weigh the lamb than feed it, as Jonathan Kozol once said. And so we test the kids.
What a great quote.
Isn't it great? And it really is metaphorically completely aligned with what's happened. And I don't think necessarily
so they're weighing the lamb, and then they're complaining it's undernourished, but they're not providing the
resources to feed it. Yes.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. And furthermore, I would say it constitutes child abuse. If you're forcing children to aspire to something that you've not helped them aspire to, how good can you feel about yourself at the end of the day that you didn't make the grade?
One of the just strangest things, and I don't know, maybe there's something I'm missing, but I've been scratching my head for years about it. This No Child Left Behind law has at its core a kind of a punitive approach to school systems. And so maybe most people by now may be familiar with the idea that if a school tests poorly, that is, if the school is said to underperform, and I'd like to get into that whole idea in a minute, but then the result is that they get their funding reduced. And I guess that strikes me as, so strange, because generally it's sort of like, well, we're not feeding the children enough, let's cut the funding because they're not growing, or something to that effect. There's just so many ways to look at it, but I guess
my metaphor would be the beatings will continue until morale is improved.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and really what's happening here, I think, is that the teachers are being beaten because what they call it failing schools now. And it used to be that it was the students that failed. And I think that there's a push, maybe ideologically, to try and get school systems and school districts and teachers to take responsibility for student achievement. And while I think, in a way, there's probably some point to that, I guess I just wonder whether that's really fair, given that it's the students who got to do the homework. It's the students who got to do the learning, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it's a little like blaming hospitals for having sick people in them. But let's look at what the criteria are. Under No Child Left Behind, they want 100% test passage rate by the year 2014. I think they've actually...
How many percent?
Well, it was 100%. I've got to say Margaret Spellings has reduced it to 99. So 99% of your students must pass all the tests or you'll be a failing school by 2014. And you have to have a 0% dropout rate by then. Or else the sanctions, progressive sanctions, will start to be in play. Now, I call that a setup for failure, that public education is being set up to fail from sea to shining sea because they haven't provided any kind of resources to develop those children. I mean, education is a 12-year enterprise. We should have been investing in them many years ago in order for that outcome by 2014. We haven't to date.
And and in particular, this is a federal government mandate. It says all states must do such and such and such and such, and it's a lot of regulations. But there's not really hasn't really been the funding given to achieve any of that.
Right. They
As a matter of fact, I was reporting a few months ago about the Health and Human Services budget, which has been cut. They actually went through, and I think there got to have been like a dozen or two dozen specific programs within the Department of Education that were you know, line by line that were being cut or eliminated. Even stuff like, you know, anti-drug training and, you know, Healthy Schools Initiative or whatever. There were all these programs, I can't remember the names of, you probably do know, that were literally being eliminated. That was the president's budget proposal. The education president, but that was a long time ago. Do you have any of those details about that budget?
I didn't bring in that budget with me, but you're right on target. And the Carl Perkins grant was another one that I think is just a travesty to cut, and that's been on his cut list for two successive budgets now. And that's the workforce training piece for community college folks that is so critical to move students who may not have come from a lot of opportunity and give them some hope for advancement. And that's kind of, you know, not to sound like Pollyanna, but that's the great American dream, isn't it? To be able to use education to elevate yourself and achieve your dreams. And those would be the last programs I would cut were I the goddess of the world. But, so we've got a program that was never funded adequately to begin with, and then it's gone through a series of federal budget cuts since then. I don't see that turning around.
Again, in case you join us late, you're listening to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. We're talking with Laurie Wimmer Whalen. I want to say Wimmer Whalen for some reason because of my old German training that's pretty rusty by now. But in any case, basically a political guru or a political advocate for the Oregon Education Association. If you want to join our conversation with a question or a brief comment, the number to call is 503-231-8187. In the meantime, of course, we have lots and lots to talk about. So No Child Left Behind, any chance it can be repealed? I mean, I just say in the next 2 years, probably the president will be reluctant to sign a repeal. But, you know, are the Democrats interested in turning this around?
Well, let's not forget that one of the authors was Senator Ted Kennedy.
I haven't forgotten.
So we're hopeful that he will be persuaded of some of the liabilities. Let's also remember that the intentions are noble. We do care about every child reaching his or her maximum potential, whatever that may be. I would argue it's not to an arbitrary line. Each person has a different set of goals and capacities. But I think every child should reach his or her dreams, and we should be there to help. And my members feel that way. But we've not funded this particular devil in the detail adequately, and I think the senator recognizes that. But whether or not the arbitrary standards, testing mania, high-stakes nature of all of that will be modified in the future is anyone's guess. We're certainly going to share our views with him.
I want to speak to something that I'd be curious to know what your position is. I'm going to preface it by saying it's sort of an odd and sort of sensitive subject. But I think that there's something underway in which, I don't know, let's just theorize that Karl Rove, who excels at this kind of stuff, must have sat down a number of years ago and said, you know, we Republicans need, in order to accomplish our various goals, discrediting government, privatizing the schools, this sort of thing, we need to have allies. And one of those allies is going to be a group of people who are maybe not content with the outcomes. They're seeing their kids go to school and fail. That's particularly African-American parents. Okay. And there's been this well-funded push for years now to try and persuade African-American parents that the school systems are failing their kids, that the teachers' unions are to blame, and to impose all sorts of really radical kinds of privatizing solutions. Here in Portland, of course, you're probably familiar with the Cascade Policy Institute. Actually, we had their executive director on this show once, a couple of years ago, and I was very disappointed to find out after the show that he misled me. I asked him what his relationship was to the Cato Institute, a well-known right-wing think tank and based in D.C. He said, oh, well, they're sister organizations. Well, turns out Cato funds the Cascade Policy Institute. There's a whole huge network for those who get their kicks late at night on the Internet. You can find out all the details, but the Cato is a well-funded, very conservative organization, and they're allied with the Cascade Policy Institute. Now, Cascade, you know, is trying to attract some credibility in some unusual quarters by bringing in well-known African-American leaders who are in this sort of conservative vein of critiquing education. And I guess I just, you know, is this something that you guys have thought about or thought about addressing? They formed an organization, for example, in Portland called the Black Association, Educational, VA. Oh, I'm messing up here, but basically they're going to be advocating something along the lines of privatizing or tuition waivers to private schools in the near future in Portland.
Well, I would just hope that that wouldn't happen, because my members believe in diversity. They believe in equality. They believe in the power of the democracy of education, Thomas Dewey on up. But if we don't recognize what the real source of the problem is, which is inadequate resources for all students to achieve, we will be vulnerable to that divide and conquer mentality. And I dare say that some folks have already fallen prey to that, and that saddens me, because we work so much better when we all work together in the progressive community. And I think that we have a long track record of doing what we can to close the achievement gaps, plural. There's not just one. There's a class gap. There are all kinds of gaps that have to do with income levels as well as race.
And that's precisely what bothers me the most about this. Here's a group of folks, I mean far-right-wing folks, okay, who basically have been advocating for years to cut Section 8 vouchers for subsidized housing. They've basically eviscerated the housing and urban development. They want to cut funding for community health clinics, they want to cut welfare. They eliminated the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Job Corps, all these kinds of things that would target, basically inner city young people, inner city working people, make sure that they have some opportunity. All those things have really just been destroyed in the last 30 years. And then they come in and say, well, really the key to economic prosperity in this country is the schools, and your kids are getting treated badly by a liberal white education establishment. Now you guys need to beat up on them. And I think that's just such an awful, awful betrayal.
Well, I think it's just disingenuous to point fingers when they ought to be pointed inward. And I also would say that there's plenty of opportunity in Portland Public Schools, which has the reputation still of being one of the finest urban public school systems in the nation. We have a lot to be proud of. And that's why so many even more affluent families put their kids in public school rather than to any of the fine private schools that they might otherwise enroll their children in. Why? Because we have a great public system. And I think the various different parent groups that come to bat whenever something is discussed, such as a closure or trying to raise money outside the education system to compensate for the severe and chronic underfunding that our schools have faced, particularly in the last 5 to 10 years since the passage of Measure 5, the property tax limitations certainly, but also in more recent years of the economic recession, we see people coming to the table, and they care about all students. And we poll on this kind of thing. We know that, for example, if you fund early education, the Head Start Oregon pre-K program, more adequately, that you'll go a long way to closing the achievement gap in the most meaningful way possible, which is to make sure that those kids at age 5 come through the schoolroom doors ready to learn.
Again, we're talking with Laurie Wimmer Whalen, who's with the Oregon Education Association, the state's largest union, and also the union represents teachers in K-12. If you want to join our conversation, I've got plenty more questions for Laurie, but if you have a question, give us a call, 503-231-8187, or just want to have a brief comment on what we're talking about. I did a story in the spring, don't know if you saw it, in the Willamette Week newspaper, about the Broad Foundation. And this is a sort of an example, maybe, of what I've been talking about. The Broad Foundation is Los Angeles base. It was founded by this guy named Eli Broad, apparently the 35th richest man in America, who all of a sudden has ideas about education. He pulled himself up by his own bootstraps, as the story goes, and he wanted to give other kids a chance to do that. And the way he would do that is by funding a kind of a conservative ideological campaign to do things like have no more unelected or no more elected school boards. Get military brass and corporate CEOs to be put in charge of school districts as administrators. A lot of states, for whatever reason, have this idea that administrators ought to have taught in the schools and know something about education, or they have these kinds of, you know, red tape requirements about who can be an administrator. But, you know, why shouldn't you be able to come from, Nabisco or something like that and run a school district? That's his idea. And he's been putting a lot of money into it. In fact, they had some very highly publicized very, very vigorous fights in Los Angeles, where he funded some school board candidates that your organization's sister group down there just fought and ultimately defeated. But they have the backing of the mayor. I mean, I don't know how much detail you want to go into, but what concerns me is this idea that we're living in a time where basically well-heeled billionaires can come in, they're unelected, and they have all this influence on what the school systems decide to do to reform themselves.
Right, and that happens especially at the ballot box. My joke is that rich guys used to buy ball clubs, now they buy ballot measures. And you saw that with a charter school law that was passed and then repealed in Washington State a while back. Paul Allen, I think, funded that campaign. And it's true a lot of places. There's also that guy from Overstock.com who had the so-called 65% solution, which was no solution at all, that would try to compel all school districts to have a certain proportion of dollars going to the classroom as he defined it, which was one of those devils in the detail again. And there are lots of examples like that out there, foundations that want to impose everything from Milton Friedman, who just expired a week or so ago, who was an economist who decided that school vouchers were the right way to go for public education or instead of public education, to various other examples that you've named. These are people who have a lot of time on their hands and apparently the resources to try to buy the experiment, but I would suggest to you that the experiment that has the most data behind it as being tried and true is that of public education in the United States. And that's the one that works for the greatest number, not perfectly, but you don't throw the proverbial baby out with the bathwater. When you've got issues, you cope with them and you figure out creative ways to improve that education system. And, you know, the rap against us sometimes is that we stand in the way of change. We don't agree. We think we are all about innovation. We think that what we don't do ever, though, is put a student at risk. You don't get an opportunity to have a do-over. If you're a second grader that year, that's it. So we want to be very careful about what we do that tampers with the educational experience of students, because we believe education is one of the most vital services provided in our society.
One of the reforms that the Broad Foundation has been pushing, and by the way, they've flown, I don't know if we should be concerned about this or not, perhaps not, but they've flown all of the Portland School Board members to Utah for a week-long training / indoctrination. No, just training, nonetheless, in good management techniques and so forth. I don't know whether their message has taken hold in Portland, and I think there may have been some resistance to it. And in any case, Portland is unique and may not be suitable for some of their experiments. But, in fact, I'm going to step back just a minute and say, what the heck are they doing with Portland? I mean, Portland is a success story. I mean, by and large, I mean, it's got some funding problems. I mean, they've got some improvements and bad management decisions, maybe. But in terms of compared to other big cities, it just doesn't really fall in the same ballpark as the other cities that they're looking at. But nonetheless, they've taken an interest in Portland. One of the things that they've pushed over the years is incentive pay for teachers. The idea that maybe somehow the student standardized test scores of a given teacher is going to determine their salary or bonuses or and stuff. What's your guys' position on something like that?
Well, needless to say, we would oppose it, have opposed it, will continue to oppose it for a couple reasons. One is that teaching is a collaborative profession when done well. When you discover a best practice or an innovation, you want to share it with your colleagues. If one person gets rewarded for that best practice at the expense of all others, then you're going to hoard your good ideas, aren't you? You're not going to share them. At least that's human nature. It doesn't promote an incentive to be more collaborative. At least there exists it. Structurally a perverse incentive with merit pay or pay for performance to that discourages collaboration. And also I would say the educators, education support professionals and teachers of the Oregon Education Association go to work to do the job they studied to do every day. They're in the classroom not because they need extra motivation such as a bonus at the end of it. This is not making widgets or selling enough real estate to go to Hawaii for your bonus vacation. This is a profession which people tend to stay for their entire adult lives when they make it past that first drop-off point I mentioned earlier. These are people who are very dedicated to their profession, and it's almost insulting to talk about merit pay. What they often do is spend hundreds, maybe even thousands of dollars out of their own pocket to supplement the inadequate budgets at their building level so that they can have adequate classroom materials and supplies and field trips for their students because they want to offer them a high-quality program, so much so that they subsidize it out of pocket. Now, these are not people who need merit pay. They've actually thrown money into the kitty in order to be able to offer those programs. They simply don't match what we know about the enterprise of education as a service profession. It doesn't fit that business market model.
It strikes me, too, that this merit pay is sort of like the carrot in the same schema as the stick of reconstitution terminating and so forth, which gets back to, I remember a few months back I interviewed Jeff Miller, who's the new, actually just this year he was elected president of Portland Association of Teachers, about these ideas. And he had a great analogy. He said, if we compare, the North Portland police precinct to Lake Oswego and say, well, look, they've got lots of crime still in North Portland, so those guys need to, get reconstituted and fired and get replaced with new ones. Whereas in Lake Oswego, there's maybe not very much crime, and so we really need to give those cops there a bonus. I mean, everyone would look at that and say that's absurd, and yet that's precisely what's being suggested for teachers.
Sure. And if I were a teacher in a school and merit pay were the law of the land, wouldn't I rather teach the tag kids rather than the difficult kids?
Right. Right, so you're going to have a migration then to the, in some ways, the easier
maybe
positions.
Or maybe not.
Yeah.
We don't know.
Sure.
I mean, as I said, the workforce I represent is very altruistic, and I think they do what they do every day because they are internally motivated to help children learn.
Again, if you want to join us, we haven't had any callers yet, but maybe people are out playing in the hail. Certainly, if you're interested in this conversation, with a chance to ask the all-powerful Teachers Union political representative, Laurie Wilmer Whalen, a question, the number to call, 503-231-8187. Or even, I dare say, if you disagree with anything that's been said and want to put your two cents in, give us a call. The issue of promotions, transfer. Actually, maybe we'll deal with transfer because that's come up recently. There's maybe concern expressed by some parents that teacher unions locally have negotiated seniority rights in transfer. Like the longer you've been with the district, kind of you get the first pick. It's kind of a complicated process that don't know if you want to go into, but nonetheless, basically the longer you stick around, you get to have some say about if there's an opportunity that you want to go to a different school. The concern is that maybe ends up depriving some of the poorer schools, for example, of the more experienced teachers. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Not necessarily. Without commenting too much about any particular school district's structure or system or negotiated agreements, I think that it's true that you have particular professionals who choose specifically to build their career in areas with low socioeconomic status populations primarily or what have you because they have a real calling to do that. And I've known a number of folks who wouldn't have it any other way. A friend of mine, as a matter of fact, was offered a job teaching math at Jefferson and a job teaching in the Beaverton schools in one of their more affluent schools. And she chose Jefferson. Why? Because that was her dedication. That was why she got her teaching degree, so that she could help. So I don't think that, those global generalizations are very helpful. I do know that when you have particularly periods of vast movements of people, either mass retirements or downsizing as a result of economic crisis, you tend to have a lot of movement around schools, and disruptions are never ideal. And you also want to have the right people in the right places. But I don't think it ever serves students or the collegiality of the faculty in any given building to impose a placement arbitrarily on a staff person.
Yet that's what they tend to seek. And I wonder how you see it. Is it simply a power question? I mean, I see, teachers unions as being this agent that ends up succeeding in many cases, negotiating kind of, rights and rules that where everyone gets treated equally, at least theoretically. Administrators don't get to, pick their cronies and give them rewards and so forth. At the same time that, people can't be fired
without cause.
Without messing up. And when they do mess up, they, under teachers' union contracts will often have an opportunity to be mentored or to have a probationary period where they can, you know, get back in shape. And the point is the difference between a union teaching environment and a non-union teaching environment seems to me is vast. And yet there's this constant battle between administrators and the teachers' unions. Or am I wrong to think that do you guys have an adversary in the Oregon Association of School Administrators? What's the group called?
The Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Actually, we work very well together and agree on about 98% of the political topics.
Like school funding.
Yes. But I would also point out to you that education as an enterprise is a very political thing. And in the old days, before collective bargaining protections existed, there were a lot of wonderful teachers who, for personality conflict reasons with their administrator or for other kinds of political speaking out or, hey, I really don't think this is the right way to run this program or this is a good decision, would be fired without cause, just as with all other collective bargaining rights that have been hard won over the years. We have a profession for which that innovation will stop if you don't have job protection for it. I would also point out with the transfer rights issue, we try to make sure that we retain our master teachers, that they don't go to other districts, that they don't leave the profession, that they don't go to other kinds of careers. Because once a district has invested in them, they have so much to offer the younger, newer members of the faculty, but they also represent a significant investment in their career. And it just makes good policy sense to do what you can to protect the seniority rights of your master teachers as one of the few benefits you get from a 30-year career.
Again, I'm talking with Laurie Wimmer-Whalen of the Oregon Education Association. You're listening to Labor Radio. Labor Radio is a weekly program about working people and the labor movement on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also 91.9 in Hood River, and 100.7 in the Willamette Valley. I'm your host, Don McIntosh. So you're seeing maybe a good deal of cooperation, in fact, with the administrators, and maybe because I'm a reporter, I always focus on the conflict and the competition. You know, I remember, though, there have been cases, and maybe I'll step back here and say, you know, it strikes me as strange that administrators in government would fight unionization or fight, many people might see as reasonable union demands. Because there's not the profit motive, there's not the incentive in a way, and yet it comes down to power. You know, several times in the last decade, the Sandy School District has had some bitter battles between the teachers' union. Well, actually, I think really them being picked on by the administrators, locked out, and called names, and just sort of, really mistreated. I had a chance to talk with some of the folks up there a few times, and just hear all the details, the sort of petty little details of what had happened.
Right. And, you know, we remember it and know a lot about it because it is the exception that proves the rule of what I said before about relative labor peace over the decades since PECPA passed in 1973, which at the time, you may not know this, but administrators and teachers were both members of the Oregon Education Association. And one of the last-minute deals that was made in order for that Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act to pass into law was that administrators had to come out. And so they ended up forming their own organization subsequent to the passage of that act. Prior to that, we were all under one roof. And as I said, there are places where the relationships are strained or worse, but in most places, we have 197 school districts and some 20 ESDs. They're represented everywhere pretty much, and you don't hear about situations such as the Sandy strike all the time, everywhere, all over the state. They are very rare.
That's a good point. Again, our number to call if you want to join our conversation, question or comment, 503-231-8187. And I understand that we have Ivan from Selwood holding on the line. Welcome to Labor Radio.
Thank you. I have a question. I was wondering, I'm a student at PSU, and I'm going to get into the graduate teaching program next year, hopefully. And I'm wondering, and I'm studying No Child Left Behind, and I'm wondering where Oregon stands on that. It seems that some of the states have had quite a bit of resistance to some of the provisions in No Child Left Behind in the last 5 years. And I was wondering if you could comment on where that sits kind of politically.
Sure. Ivan, welcome to the teaching profession. I hope you realize your dreams.
You.
We need all the good people we can get. No Child Left Behind at the federal level still exists and probably, as we discussed earlier, isn't likely to be repealed anytime soon, though it will come up for reauthorization probably in the next Congress. At the state level, we have certainly resisted attempts by some to add a layer to state law that mimics the federal, and so far have succeeded in keeping it out of Oregon statutes. Nonetheless, we are one of, I think, 49 states that received the federal funds and therefore must comply, and our Department of Ed is doing what it can to what I would say is modify the way it's implemented on the ground. They've really actually been pretty impressive and have tried twice to get approval for something called a growth model that would measure student learning gains rather than measuring to the absolute standard I discussed earlier. They've not succeeded in getting one of the federal grants and permission to do that yet, but I think they're going to stay at the table until they get that done. They've been really good advocates for praising the achievement goals of the law without, doing some of the more what we consider to be educationally unsound aspects of it to the extent that they're permitted to do it. And I think only the state of Utah has said we would rather not get the federal money than comply.
Okay, right. I saw one of the criticisms of the act was that the tests that they administer are simply snapshots, and that they don't measure child's progress through the system. They just
right.
take a shot each
right.
grade level. And that, what does that really tell you?
Well, what else they do is they compare one set of third graders against next year's set of third graders or last year's set of third graders. That tells you absolutely nothing at all.
Right. So is that going to stay in effect in the next few years as I enter into it? I'm just kind of curious to see politically. There's been, I guess, not as much resistance as I thought.
It has to happen at the federal level.
Federal money.
Yeah. Well, it has to happen at the federal level. That's where the law has to be changed.
Ivan, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Again, the number to call, 503-231-8187. The No Child Left Behind thing, it strikes me as being part of a trend, in a way, away from local control. I mean, this is a mandate, by U.S. Congress on, a group of school districts that are essentially local in character. I mean, this is also, I think, one of the things that's sort of strange to me, which theoretically, America has a pretty strange approach to public education in that, for the most part, local districts raise the money, elect the administrators, or excuse me, elect the board that hires the administrators that oversees the districts and so forth. And yet, there's an incredible sameness, almost wherever you go throughout the country in public schools, same textbooks, same bells, same lockers. I mean, not to, an exact degree, but considering that they're theoretically so local, I guess it strikes me as strange that it's so homogenous. Is there a sense in which we have only an illusion of local control, and that the bigger agenda is being set by the state or the federal government?
Well, I would point out that 50 different states have 50 different funding structures, and it is true that most of them had been locally financed. In Oregon, of course, when our property tax limitations measures passed, both in 1990 and 1996 and 7, we pretty much gave up most of our local control in the sense that, the perversion of the golden rule, he with gold rules, put most of the funding responsibility on the state rather than on the county property tax and local level, and moved away from the levy system to basically an income tax finance system and asked the state to backfill for a period of time the losses when we cut property taxes. So when the state had to take over the funding of Oregon's K-12 system, it no longer was a locally financed
system. One of the painful things about that, it seems to me, is that the political will for adequate funding comes at the local level. So you could get parents to get out there and say, pass this levy, it'll fund our schools, et cetera, et cetera. But it's much harder to get, a state elected, legislature from around the state to feel that pressure. I imagine that must be much of your job, is to make those folks feel that pressure.
Well, pressure might be one way of putting it. We certainly want our members to tell their stories, our students to tell their stories, and the parents to tell their stories, and they do so very effectively, and that's been very helpful. But you're right. When we had the old levy system, though it was imperfect, and one of the ways it was imperfect is that property-poor areas couldn't compete to offer the same level of opportunities to students as property-rich areas, and that's been fixed a little bit. What also happened, though, is that districts had to go out and have a dialogue with their local community, and that's been lost when we lost those local levy elections.
Again, if you want to join our conversation, question, or comment, 503-231-8187, and we have David from Southeast Portland. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. Now, I'm actually coming from the opposite end of the political spectrum, I'm sure, from you guys, even though I do agree with a lot of, you know, things like teachers union just fine. I'm against the mandatory testing of students, but that kind of takes me to sort of the ultimate of local control, moving away from the coercive education system that the public system represents and towards like a free school or democratic schooling type of system, at least as an option. And that's sort of what I'm looking at, is having more options. And I don't see that as a negative thing overall.
Tara, you want to comment?
Sure. You know, the whole issue of school choice and student and parent choice has been an interesting one, because there are elements of that that are about innovations in teaching and learning and about playing to student strengths and giving, you know, something other than a one-size-fits-all institutionalized curriculum. And that's been a part of the education pedagogy. It's not just a political force that's come in from outside and tried to change public education. It's evolved in a responsible way for some of those kinds of experiences for years. I would point out, for example, Portland Public Schools' magnet school programs. There are art schools, there are math and science schools, there are language immersion schools, there are all sorts of alternatives. There's environmental middle school. There are a number of different options for students to pursue. And to a lesser degree, some of the public charter schools in the various school districts around the state have also contributed to that innovation, teaching and learning, and offering options and choices. And so my caveat to that would be, as long as that's a controlled experiment wherein students' best interests aren't sacrificed for some adult's vision, you know, that these are research-based and tested ideas, so you don't put kids in jeopardy, as has happened a couple places. And as long as these are done in a predictable and financially responsible way, so that, again, kids aren't left high and dry when a school has to shut its doors for financial reasons. Again, that's a very common problem, for example, with charter schools in some states.
The financial part of that's a little hard to, you know, address generally, but the idea that you have to build to, I don't know, address the welfare of the child. You know, the idea of the free school is not so much that we have to structure the program that the child goes through, but that the child is allowed to structure their own system.
The one thing I have a quarrel with about all of that is that we focus on the children who are getting to have the alternative choice, and sometimes we forget all the students who are left behind in the traditional program, because if the resources that follow the child to the alternative rob the rest of the kids of the choice of staying in the traditional program, you've selected a subset of children and elevated their needs and concerns over that of the rest of the kids.
Not at all. You've done just the opposite. You've provided the choice where, if all the money is going to the public system, that elevates the public system above all other choices.
David, I want to thank you for your call this evening on Liberty.
Right.
Just wanted to maybe offer my own two cents as well. It seems to me that one of the things that concerns me about the sort of carving off little experiments thing, I mean, in a way, I think that the idea is sort of appealing, particularly if you're looking at alternative education methods. But, you know, I really worry about this country polarizing in so many ways, economically in particular, but also socially. And one of the few, I don't know if you can call it a benefit, but there's something about public schools that says we're all in this together. In many cases, and like my experience, you know, this is the only time in people's lives when people from different socioeconomic backgrounds will be forced to actually like get to know each other. Maybe they don't even get along, but that there's an opportunity, there's a chance. I fear that we're so, in so many ways, moving into a kind of society with gated communities and private schools, and you know, maybe some of these private schools are going to be publicly funded, but the idea is the same, that people are going to sort of segregate themselves into little groups that don't really interact with each other. And I don't know if there's a way to for for public education to, you know, somehow be universal in a positive sense without being, you know, having an unhealthy regimentation that, you know, sort of stifles democracy or that promotes mediocrity?
Well, again, I think it comes down to funding. We've seen precisely what you've described in some places on the East Coast that are farther down that road of some of those experiments that I consider to be somewhat unwise. And when I said before to the last caller that it imperils the educational experience of the kids left behind the brick-and-mortar school, that is a very real problem in some of the East Coast states where the charter school movement has imposed itself in such a way that the public school managers, the boards, and the administrators can't cope with the loss of funding and predict it in advance and offer the same quality level of program as they had in the old days. And so we've got to be very careful about making sure that public resources are spent in as responsible and as fair a way as possible for the benefit of all children.
Again, the number to call with a question or comment, join our conversation, is 503-231-8187. And I think we have Carolyn, was it Cedar Hills you're joining us from? Carolyn, welcome to Liberty.
Yes, thank you for the introduction. Actually, I am from Hillsboro.
Hillsboro, I'm sorry, I just, my memory's
bad. No problem.
Welcome to Liberty.
Taking notes quickly and reading handwriting. A teacher in the blood. I'm calling because there was a bond that was requested from the voters in Hillsboro for the schools. There were also two or three or so other bonds which passed for other issues. And the school bond did not pass. And it happens that I'm a homeowner and I'm also a caregiver. Kudos to SEIU and your program. Thank you. That side issue. But the point is, the purpose of call is my considering the fact that not all homeowners are people with children, as in myself. Not all homeowners are middle-aged. Many, a substantial number of homeowners are elder, who are totally out of the loop and have been to so for at least several decades, to say, you know, that's area. Tara, and there needs to be a manner of participation for those who rent, but who are also understandably struggling to make ends meet, as homeowners also are. This is sort of a dilemma that I don't know the answer to.
I think I understand where you're coming from, though.
It's important to be tossed about by those who can set up some kind of structure legally and taxation wise so that the people who are actually benefiting from the schools are providing for their children.
Right.
And the people who could provide through bonds and whatnot as homeowners can, but there's, you know, there's this dilemma.
Yeah, I want to give our guest a chance to respond. Laurie, is it are people bad if they vote against school levies?
Let me correct the record on a couple things. First of all, in Hillsboro, believe it or not, though they originally thought it went down to defeat, it did pass, and about a little bit more than 40% of all of the various different local option levies and bond levies on the ballot for November 2006 did pass in communities all over Oregon. In fact, more than $1.1 billion was raised. But the caller makes a great point about asking the question, who benefits, who is paying their fair share, and so on. One of the issues that on one of my hats is that I chair the Revenue Coalition for the state of Oregon, and we concern ourselves with the tax side of the issue significantly and have for a number of years. And, you know, there are a number of ways to make sure that those who are lower income aren't disproportionately bearing the share of the responsibility, and that can be done through all kinds of methods, homestead exemptions and so on, all of which we've advocated for. The property tax system for collecting some of the revenues for schools is one of those controversial kinds of things. It's a state stable tax, but you're right. You pay it if you're a homeowner, or actually through the price of your rent, your landlord pays it too. Economists actually consider a portion of rent and they ascribe it to property taxes. So, but it is kind of a classic class issue, whether or not folks are being disproportionately burdened. One of the things we've advocated is in areas with high growth where there's a need for new school buildings, for example, which is what a lot of bond options are for, or for renovations of schools because you have an influx of students, is some kind of system development charge or school impact fees from the segment of the population that's buying those homes that's causing that need, that direct need for that school. But one last thing would be to suggest that we all benefit from a highly educated population, not only because we're growing humans who will be our doctors and our caregivers and our lawyers and our truck drivers and so on someday, but also because there's a direct economic benefit for a K-12 investment that actually stimulates a more robust economy and raises the lake for all boats.
Not to mention that if the kids are in school, they're not out robbing your house.
No, I'm
be completely facetious, of course. I wanted to thank Carolyn for that call and also say we have just a few minutes left. We're talking with Laurie Wimmer Whalen, the lobbyist for the state's teachers union. And the number to call, if you maybe want to be our last caller, 503-231-8187. Yes, it seems to me I want to pay for fire service even if my house never burns down, and I've got a kid now, and so of course I'm particularly invested in the schools. But I hear the concern, not even just necessarily about, do I have to pay for something that I don't use, but can I afford to pay? And I think that our system is really, really so weighted towards the property taxes. Property taxes really are very high, particularly for the seniors who may be on a fixed income. The housing is appreciating, the property taxes is going up, but their income may or may not be going up quite as much. And I guess, I don't know if you guys are you part of a group of unions and organizations that's advocating for a more progressive taxation? You mentioned the homestead exemption, but what about getting corporations to pay their fair share like they used to 20, 30 years ago?
We've been on board with all of those ideas, but I will correct you on one tiny little thing, which is that our property taxes used to be among the highest in the country. Now we're about average, and the actual rate of, on a per capita basis, of total taxes paid per person is lower today than it was in 1999. So people's perception is that they've gone up, but that's because in a lot of cases either their incomes have gone up or values have gone up. But we now have a cap that artificially restricts the growth of value on which the property tax is assessed to 3% per year maximum, as well as limiting the millage rate on how much per $1,000 of assessed value can actually be taxed. So on both sides of that equation, property taxes have been pretty well limited.
We have, I think, last caller here. Just very quickly, if you have Ernie from Northeast Portland, you're joining us on Labor Radio. What's your question?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a point, and perhaps your guest can speak to it a little better than I could, is to her the last point that she was responding to regarding the last caller, that everyone benefits from a good educational system, especially places like Hillsborough, where Intel is, and a company which complains of not being able to get an educated workforce locally. It seems like that's an extremely important point to bring out, and I was wondering if you could speak to that a little more.
Okay, Laurie.
I'd be happy to. We know that when you ask CEOs of corporations what is the most important decision in relocating or expanding inside a state with your business, they say a well-qualified, well-educated workforce is their number one consideration. And among that, they also say quality of life issues. And a subset of quality of life is, can their executives that they hire or their engineers or what have you send their kids to the public school that's nearby and local? And so, Ernie, you're absolutely right. These are the things that matter to businesses, and if we want to grow Oregon's economy, even if we didn't care about the human potential that's wasted when you don't educate a society, you ought to care about your economy and the opportunities that come from job creation and personal income growth. And when, we haven't learned how to outsource teachers yet, so all those dollars are staying inside the state's borders. So every dollar invested in public education stays and recirculates in Oregon's economy and results in a more vibrant economy.
That's about all the time we have this evening. I want to thank you, the listener, for listening to Labor Radio on KBO Portland. I'm Don McIntosh. This is actually my last program as a host. I've been at it for 7 or 8 years. I may come on maybe as a guest at some point, but every dog has its day. Anyway, it's been a pleasure. I want to thank our engineer, Ben Levine, and our guest, Larry Wimmer Whalen, tonight from the Oregon Education Association. We hope you'll tune in again next week, the following Monday at 6 p.m. for Labor Radio. Host Bill Zimmerman will be airing that show.